Norwood, who's going to speak to us.
He's going to tell us the truth.
In an uncertain world. So would you welcome Taylor Norwood, please?
Green light and red light.
Yeah, that's good. Oh.
One minor correction in my introduction. I don't yet have my PhD. I'm ABD. I'm in the dissertation phase right now. So one of these days, I will have that dissertation done with coursework, but have that PhD sooner rather than later, hopefully. But I'd like to start with two quotes tonight to kind of frame the discussion that was made for us. The first is a popular quote in the 16th century.
All of a sudden, your sales are gone.
Do you have a red light on the one in your pocket?
I do.
Turn the volume up on him right here.
Maybe.
There you go.
We're hearing you now.
Okay. Is that a little bit better?
I can also just talk really, really loud. That's what my kids and my students can attest. So I'll start with two quotes tonight to frame our discussion and kind of set the stage for us. The first is a proverb that dates to the mid-16th century. It is, quote, "Children and fools tell the truth," end quote. The second comes from the main subject of tonight's talk, Montaigne. Montaigne tells us that only the fools are certain and assured. Truth seems to have fallen on hard times of late. Consensus on any issue seems almost impossible, and conflict and disagreement abound. For every protest, there is a counter-protest. We could call it the first rule of contemporary discussion, that for every opinion, there is an equally extreme and opposite position. Politicians from either party are branded liars by the other, but the problem extends far beyond politics. Fake news and post-truth are the buzzwords of the day. So how are we to make sense of such a world? For an answer tonight, I will turn to the man often described as the first modern thinker, Michel Etienne de Montaigne. And I have two goals tonight. The first is to introduce you to Montaigne in a general sense. That's the easy part. You could ask my students, I can ramble on endlessly about Montaigne. The second is a little bit more difficult. I want to convince you that you ought to read Montaigne. And this is his one and only book, The Essays. And it's a bit of a clunker. It's a doorstop. So I recognize that this second task is a little bit more difficult. To accomplish that goal, I hope to show you how Montaigne might offer us some useful lessons on navigating a world in which truth itself is open for debate. Before I start, I am always curious when I give this sort of talk. Has anybody here heard of Montaigne before tonight? A few people have heard of him. Anybody read him by chance? Okay. Not surprised, that's okay.
Just saying.
So, you're not alone. There are a lot of people, including philosophy professors, including people who are experts even in modern philosophy, that have never actually read Montaigne, even though he is... known to have this great reputation, so you're in good company. And I can also recommend a non-expert book that's a good introduction to Montaigne. I want you to recommend that a little bit later. So I'll start tonight with a little bit of background on Montaigne to just kind of situate us historically and understand where Montaigne fits into everything. And I will make a brief note on pronunciation. It is spelled Montaigne, as you can probably see there. This is one of those things that different people care a lot about, some people don't care. I'm not really concerned with pronunciation. Technically, it's supposed to be Montendia, because when he lived, French pronunciation was different, so technically that's the correct pronunciation. The more common one that I have heard is just Montaigne, and you kind of lose the y at the end. But then a lot of people also say Montaigne, especially here in Texas. I'll probably slip into that occasionally because I just can't get around it. But they are all the same person. So Montaigne, 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 all the same guy. Montaigne lived from 1533 to 1592, and he was born into a newly noble family. So his name is officially Michel Etienne de Montaigne. The de in French signals aristocracy. And this was not an old money family. They made their money. There's actually a Chateau de Kim wine that still exists to this day that is associated with Montaigne's family. They didn't have the wine money then. They made their money before Montaigne came on the scene selling salted fish. So they were very much a new money family and wanted to look the part, wanted to be fit the bill of an aristocratic family. Along those lines, Montaigne went to law school because his father wanted him to, and he served in the local parliament, which is not parliament, as we would think of, it's more like a local law court. He served in the local law court as a young man. But then in 1571, he retires at the age of only 38. He retires to the tower of his castle to write his essays. I'm 33, so I'm really looking forward to retirement in a few years. During this quote-unquote retirement, he continued to be very active. We sometimes have this image of Montaigne locked in his tower, writing constantly on the essays, and that's not a completely accurate picture. It's more of a romantic notion. In reality, during his retirement, he continues to go to all the best parties. He serves as the mayor of Bordeaux twice. Bordeaux at this point was one of the leading cities of France. Not quite up there with Paris, but it was an important post to be mayor of Bordeaux. He was also a negotiator for Henry of Navarre, who would go on to become Henry IV of France. He travels to Rome and back and to a few other places in Europe looking for a cure for kidney stones, which is the ailment that eventually killed him as well. And in the midst of that, he composes his one and only published book, which is the Essays. There is a travel journal that has been published long after he died, but the one book that he deliberately published is this one right here, the Essays. So that's Montaigne's biography in a nutshell. His historical context is a little bit more interesting, because he lives right through the French Wars of Religion. So the French Wars of Religion are typically dated from 1562 to 1598, which overlaps with nearly all of Montaigne's life. The French Wars of Religion were extremely bloody and extremely violent. It's really hard to exaggerate just what a horrible time in European history, specifically French history, it's like. I mean, you have members of the same family fighting against each other. Several of Montaigne's siblings, for example, were Protestants. Montaigne himself was a Catholic. They never took up arms against each other, but plenty of other families did. Their neighbor fighting against neighbor. The nobility was split. It was a very ugly time in French history. Just one example, the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, which was a targeted massacre against French Protestants, the Huguenots, and then Catholic mob violence following that massacre. Estimates of the number killed in just the span of a couple of days range from 5,000 on the low end to 30,000 on the high end. It's just an example of the level of bloodshed we're talking about. So however chaotic, however bad our times seem now, I promise you, Montaigne was in for a rougher time. He was also a negotiator and advisor for Henry of Navarre, who was the leading Huguenot figure, the leading French Protestant figure. He was also a direct descendant of Louis IX, which meant he had royal blood. And in fact, he winds up being the heir to Henry III, who is the Catholic King of France. So these are the two guys on opposite sides fighting the French Wars of Religion. Eventually, Henry of Navarre converts back to Catholicism. He famously says Paris is well worth a mass when he has to, in order to earn the crown, he has to convert that to Catholicism. And he does so. So this is the context that Montaigne lives in. It's a violent time, a bloody time, an uncertain time. And all
that circles back to a dispute over truth. It's fundamentally a war between two different confessional traditions, right? Two different claims to what is true. So the conflict in Montana State is very much tied to what people thought was true. Montaigne, for his part, I already mentioned he's a Catholic, he was very, very modest. And in fact, he took no active part in the wars with it. Didn't lead any troops, never fought in battle, did not let his castle become a fort for either side. And in fact, a couple of times soldiers came planning to take over his castle and he kind of talked him down. So he was respected by both sides, partly because he stayed out of the conflict. He was known for giving good advice. He was known for keeping his mouth shut and not telling things that people had told him. And this earned him a lot of respect. He also lived in disputed territory in the southwest of France. So he is literally on the front lines of the wars of religion. He's not in a Catholic stronghold, Protestant stronghold. I mean, they're literally out his window. This is where the wars are being fought. So this is a very dangerous time to be a French noble. So he retires to his tower. Maybe now it's a little more understandable why he's not going to lock himself in a tower, given what's going on around him. And he writes the essays. I'm sure that we all have the notion of an essay in our mind. You have probably written some. In your time, I've written more than I can even begin to count on my way to my PhD. Montaigne is the first to use this word, essay, in the title of the book. He is the original. And his essays are nothing like what we think of when we picture an essay. We hear the word essay, and we tend to think of a discrete paper that's clearly structured, that is unified by a single topic. That's not Montaigne. Now, the chapters in his book, and I'll call them chapters for reasons that I'll talk about in just a second. The chapters in his book all have titles, so just flipping this open, Of Solitude is one, Of Drunkenness is another. All things have their seasons, and it seems like he has things here. And yet when you read these essays, they just cover a huge variety of topics, sometimes very much seemingly at random. The form of the book itself was gradually developed. It was first published in 1580. It was divided into two books then, comprising 94 chapters, what are usually called essays. And then he immediately set about revising it. And in 1588, he published a second edition, which had three books now, and he was up to 107 essays or chapters. Even then, it wasn't done. He continued to revise it, even just making notes in the margin, up until he died, and these revisions would be published after his death. And you can track these developments, by the way. If you get a copy of it, the editors tend to mark which edition his sentences came in so that you can really track the development of this volume. The content of it is very interesting. I'll read you just briefly his little note to the reader telling you what this book is about. He says, "This book was written in good faith, reader. It warns you from the outset that in it I have set myself no goal but a domestic and private one. I have had no thought of serving either you or my own glory. My powers are inadequate for such a purpose. I have dedicated it to the private convenience of my relatives and friends so that when they have lost me, as soon they must, they may recover here some features of my habits and temperament, and by this means keep the knowledge they have had of me more complete and alive. If I had written this with the world's favor, I should have bedecked myself better and should present myself in a studied posture. I want to be seen here in my simple, natural, ordinary fashion, without straining or artifice, for it is myself that I portray. My defects will here be read to the light, and also my natural form, as far as respect for the public has allowed. Had I been placed among those nations which are said to live still in the sweet freedom of nature's first laws, I assure you I should very gladly have portrayed myself here, entire and wholly naked. Thus, reader, I am myself the matter of my book. You would be unreasonable to spend your leisure on so frivolous and vain a subject. So farewell. Montaigne, this first day of March, 1580. So a few things to note there. First, he says that this is just a book for his family and friends so that they can remember him after he dies. And then he publishes it, and it's a bestseller across France. Already, there's a little question about the purpose of the book here. He says that it is himself that he portrays, right? He is the subject of his work. So we might expect something like biographies, like memoir. Nothing like that happens in the essays. Occasionally he'll give us an anecdote about his life, but it's always to support some other point that he's made. So this is not biography, this is not confession like St. Augustine, this is not memoir, it's not even a philosophical manifesto, it's not even that philosophical. So what is it? Well, it's the essays. That's the best answer anybody can give. It might help to know that the word essay comes from essayer, which is a verb in French which means to attempt or to try. So he literally named this book The Attempts. The Attempts of what? We're not exactly sure. So the form of the book is very challenging because it seems very random at times. Hopefully I'll convince you it's not quite as random as it seems by the end of tonight. So Montaigne occupies a really unusual position. He is often lauded as a pivotal and inventive literary figure for the essays because they gave birth to this new mode of writing, and he's recognized as an important figure in the history of philosophy. But as I already told you, there are plenty of philosophers that have never read it because this importance often derives more from his relationship to other thinkers than from his own thought. He is seen as an important link between the ancients, whom he quotes plentifully. There are literally thousands of quotations in the essays, and the moderns, who were influenced to varying degrees by his new style and his willingness to break with tradition. As a philosopher in his own right, he is often relegated to the second rank. Montaigne downplays his own importance, of course, as we saw in the note to the reader when he says, literally, it would be frivolous to spend your leisure time on such a vain subject. He tells the reader, don't even bother reading this. And then he proceeds to write 900 pages that we shouldn't bother with. His style is too casual and his thoughts are too scattered to merit serious philosophical consideration. This is the standard one. He has even been called the first blogger, which is not exactly a great honorific from a philosophical standpoint. Anne Hartle, a philosopher writing at Emory University, puts it plainly. She says, quote, although his essays have always been acknowledged as the origin of the new literary genre, they have never been recognized as philosophical in the modest sense, end quote. She goes on to argue, and I agree, that Montaigne is worthy of being recognized as a first-rate philosopher in his own right. The casual style, the apparently scattershot topics of the essays allow the reader to slip into the shallow region. It's really easy to just read the surface of Montaigne. He's kind of like Nietzsche in that regard. If you've read any Nietzsche, there's an impression you get reading him casually, and then if you really pay attention, there's a deeper meaning. Montaigne is very similar. Careful study reveals a more subtle and nuanced thinker than is often recognized. That's my contention. In terms of reputation, I already told you as a literary figure, he's in the upper echelon. The essays are one of the great works of the French literary tone. As a philosopher, he's often overlooked, and yet some really important people have spent a lot of time writing about. So just in the generation after him, Pascal and Descartes were both readers of Montaigne. They were not fans of Montaigne, but they were readers of Montaigne. More recently, Nietzsche and Emerson were both devotees of Montaigne. And there are many, many more that I could point to, and T.S. Eliot is another one who wrote essentially on Montaigne, or at least wrote a few essays on Montaigne. So he has this big reputation in a small group of thinkers, and then he has a very short blurb in most philosophy textbooks that the average thinker reads. So why bother then? Besides this claim that I'm telling you that he has this great reputation, a few things that I think recommend him to a non-academic reader. First off, I hope I haven't scared you off by saying that it's kind of random, that it doesn't have a unifying topic. This actually makes him so much more fun to read. If you have ever slogged your way through Aristotle, I'm not knocking Aristotle, clearly, it's hugely important as a philosopher. And yet, if you read Aristotle, it is not the most enjoyable experience you will ever have in your life. Reading Montaigne is a very enjoyable experience. You never know what to expect from him. There's always something new. Just when you think you can get any stranger, he'll come up with another essay, and you think, what in the world is he talking about? My favorite example of that, he has an essay that's literally titled, Of Thumbs, which boils down to the point of how weird are thumbs. seems crazy, but in the larger picture, it actually makes a point in the book. Some other things he recommended too. He is incredibly honest, and he is incredibly funny. Just to give you one example of this, at one point in the essays, I don't want to scandalize anybody too much here, but he laments all of the pornographic graffiti that pops up in the back alleys, because he says that these obscene pieces of art have so inflated a woman's expectations that when she actually winds up in bed with a man, she can't help but be disappointed, which I've always thought was pretty funny. So that's his humor. His honesty is then he goes one step further and he says nature has been particularly cruel to him in that regard. So what I always tell my students is if a man is honest about that, he's going to be honest about it. So he's very entertaining. He's very honest. He's an enjoyable read. He's the kind of philosopher that you can pick up and read 5 or 10 pages in the evening and you feel like you just barely read a paragraph. It's very enjoyable to read. More specifically, though, I think he offers us insights that can help us navigate the world that we live in, especially when it comes to the question of truth. Monahan has an approach to truth that kind of gets overshadowed by modern philosophy and all of the outgrowths from it. So returning to Monahan, I think, can really give us something useful for the world we live in. So how then do we find truth, according to Monahan? Well, he tells us that there are three sects of philosophers. Let me turn here. He says that whoever seeks anything comes to this point. He says either that he has found it, or that it cannot be found, or that he is still in quest of it. All philosophy is divided into these three types. Its purpose is to seek out truth, knowledge, and certainty. And then he tells us that philosophers fall into these three categories. There are the dogmatists. These are the groups that say that they have found truth. So others, the Peripatetics, the Epicureans, the Stoics, and others thought they had found it being true. These established the sciences that we have and treated them as certain knowledge. So that's option one. How do we find truth? We already found it. Rest assured, it's okay. The second answer are the academics. So Platonicus, Carneades, and the academics despaired of their quest and judged the truth could not be conceived by our powers. The conclusion of these men was man's weakness and ignorance. This school has had the greatest following and the noblest adherents. So he says the school that had the greatest following and the most noble adherents conclude that we can't find truth, we'll never find truth. Instead, let's spend our time lamenting how miserable man's condition is. So nothing can be known. We can't know, so give up. That's the answer that the academics give. And then there are Hero and other skeptics or effectists, whose doctrines many of the ancients maintained were derived from Homer, the Seven Sages, Archilochus, and Euripides, and were held by Zeno, Democritus, Xenophanes, a few big names in ancient philosophy. The skeptics say that they are still in search of the truth. These men judge that those who think they have found it are infinitely mistaken, and that there is also an overbold vanity in that second class that assures us that human powers are not capable of attaining it. So, our options, according to the three main sects of philosophy, according to Montaigne here, are the dogmatists. We already know truth. Mission complete. Second group, the academics. We can't know truth. Give up now. Don't waste your time. And the third group, are the Pyrrhonists, or the skeptics. They're called Pyrrhonists after Pyrrho, who's the earliest skeptic philosopher. They say, we don't know what the answer is. We don't know what truth is, so we're going to keep looking. Specifically, the skeptic motto is epeko, which means I hold back, I do not judge. Literally, I suspend my judgment. So the Pyrrhonist technique was to balance opposing arguments so that this leads to the suspension of judgment. Take one argument, and once you find an equally persuasive argument that offsets it, you say, whoa, I can't decide. I will suspend judgment. You take a step back. This is supposed to lead to ataraxia, which is tranquility. This is freedom from stress, essentially. You don't have to make a judgment. You can relax. That's the skeptic answer. Montaigne is usually labeled as a skeptic. I told you he's often viewed as more of a mouthpiece of the ancients, and this is one of those areas. A lot of
philosophers who summarize Montaigne, just say, Montaigne is a skeptic. That's it. He's just the ancient reborn. And this seems reasonable. His personal motto was que sais-je, which literally means, what do I know? And he challenges dogmatism, just like the skeptics. Just one example of this is cultural relativism. Montaigne is often pointed to as one of the first cultural relativists. In the essays, he famously skewers French culture for thinking they're so much better than the quote-unquote barbarian or cannibal cultures found in the New World. And he says, really, the difference just boils down to the French wear pants. He says, sure, that they're cannibals over there, but it's much worse to eat a man when he is still alive than to consume him after he's dead. And he says, that's what the French do, and that's what the Inquisition does. They consume them while they're still alive. So we can see how he challenges these dogmatic attitudes, these views that we already know what's best. So we are French, of course we're better than you. All right? That's Montaigne, the cultural relativist. We see this notion of skepticism. He doesn't say the cultures of the New World are better. He doesn't say French are worse. He just says, hey, maybe you're not so different after all. Who can say? Right? He also rejects the academics. He says, claiming that we can't know anything is already claiming more knowledge than you could possibly have. Because in order to be able to say that there's no way human beings could ever be able to reach truth, you would have to completely comprehend every facet of your intellect. And he says, that's foolhardy. You think too much of yourselves already if you say we know enough to say we'll never know the truth. So he rejects the academics. So this curious, this skeptical influence is certainly here in the essays. He quotes Sextus Empiricus, who outlined Pyrrho's philosophy of skepticism. He quotes him regularly. He praises the Pyrrhonists highly. Has a lot of good things to say about them, that they have the most peaceful life. And yet, this is a major issue of debate among Montaigne's scholars, because he doesn't quite fit the bill of a pure Pyrrhonist skeptic, because he doesn't suspend his judgment. He doesn't go through life never making a judgment either way about things. He says that he admires them, he says that this is certainly the most tranquil way to live, but that's not what he does in the essays. He offers plenty of opinions, he offers plenty of judgments in the essays. So he's not quite the skeptic that he is sometimes made out to be. Some have argued that he's more of what philosophers call an academic skeptic, not to be confused with Montaigne's academics. We say that we can't know anything. And an academic skeptic admits that some judgments might be more plausible than others. There are some things that just seem more reasonable than others. And it's okay to say that this seems more reasonable. The idea seems more reasonable. And the emphasis here is on fallibility, right? This seems more reasonable, but hey, I could be wrong, right? So the academic skeptic is skeptical, but not to the point that they completely suspend judgment. They disqualify their judgment by keeping their own fallibility in mind. And they argue both sides of issues. Right? So how can I know that this side is more reasonable unless I fully understand this side? So I'll argue this side the best that I can. Montaigne does this all the time in the essays. You'll see him quote both answers to a question just to see what he thinks of them in comparison to one another. So this seems maybe more accurate, Montaigne. The problem with this answer too, this identification of Montaigne as an academic skeptic, is that it's entirely based on one single chapter in this book. Now, it's the longest chapter by far. It's called The Apology for Raymond Sebald. It's often published as a standalone book, and we don't need to necessarily get into the whole story of this. But essentially, he's trying to defend a French author, a theologian, of which his father was a huge fan, against critics. And the problem for Montaigne is he doesn't really agree with Raymond Sebald either. So his answer is skepticism. Right? So his critics are wrong because of all these skeptical arguments that show that they can't really know what they're talking about. So he quotes a lot of skeptical philosophers in The Apology for Raymond Sebald. The problem is these references to skeptics like Sextus Empiricus, you don't find them nearly as much in the other chapters of the essays. You find plenty of quotes from a lot of other people, not so much from the skeptics. So Montaigne as a skeptic is perhaps overemphasized because it's based only on this one section. He quotes many, many other people too. And he also warns of the risks of skepticism. So this particular
chapter of the Apology for Raymond Savant was dedicated to Margaret of Valois, who was the daughter of Henry of Navarre, because she too was a fan of Raymond Savant. And so he gives her all these skeptical arguments for shooting down Savant's critics, and then he says, in this warning to the princess, he says, "You for whom I have taken the pains to extend so long a work, contrary to my custom, will not shrink from upholding your Savant by the ordinary form of argument in which you are instructed every day, and in that you will exercise your mind and your learning." In other words, he's telling her, just argue with these critics the best you can, the way you learned in school. "Because," he says, "for this final fencer's trick must not be employed except as an extreme remedy. It is a desperate stroke in which you must abandon your weapons to make your adversary lose his, and a secret trick that must be used rarely and deservedly. It is great rashness to ruin yourself in order to ruin another." So using skeptical arguments to cut somebody else's argument down cuts the ground out from under you, too. I should say that 150 or 200 years after the essays were published, they were placed on the Index of Prohibited Books by the Catholic Church, largely because of their skepticism. At this point, it was recognized that, hey, maybe skepticism can undercut Catholic teaching, too. And it remained on the Index of Prohibited Books for a couple of centuries. But again, this view of Montaigne as the ultimate skeptic is skewed because it emphasizes this one part of the essays. And it gives us a warning here. Be careful. If you want to use skepticism, it's a really dicey way to argue. And I already mentioned he doesn't suspend judgment over the course of the essays. In fact, he does the opposite. Give you just one example here. He says, towards the end of the essay, this is one of his later ones that he wrote, "Judgment holds in me a magisterial seat. At least it carefully tries to. It lets my feelings go their way, both hatred and friendship, even the friendship I bear myself, without being changed and corrupted by them. If it cannot reform the other parts according to itself, at least it does not let itself be deformed to match them. It plays its game apart. The advice to everyone to know himself must have an important effect, since the god of learning and life had it planted on the front of his temple, as comprising all the counsel he had to give us. Plato also says that wisdom is nothing else but the execution of his command, that is, know thyself. And Socrates in Xenophon verifies it in detail." So he says, not that he suspends judgment, he says, my judgment stays separate from my feelings, stays separate from my hatred, my friendship. It is not affected. When it can't correct those tendencies, it just stays away from it. So Montaigne does not suspend judgment. What he does is he maintains it separate from his other inclinations. And that's an important point that we'll return to. And all of this boils down to one important point that is often overlooked. The goal of the skeptics is tranquility, right? This ataraxia I told you about. That is not Montaigne's goal. Montaigne's goal is to show himself. Right? He said it in the very beginning. This is a book written in good faith, reader. My goal here is to paint an accurate picture of myself. Right? If I could, I would show myself completely naked. And then he pretty much does that when he laments his natural shortcomings. So his goal is not tranquility. This automatically divides him from the skeptics. He has a very different goal in mind. His goal is showing himself, gaining self-knowledge. Right? Montaigne doesn't eliminate his beliefs in the essays. He offers, as I already said, plenty of opinions. What he does is he qualifies them. If he offers a judgment about something, if he offers an opinion about something, he always says something to the effect of, maybe I'm wrong, or perhaps I am mistaken, or maybe I don't understand this fully, or you know, my reason is so weak and so feeble, I probably not feel that. Right? That's the kind of qualification Montaigne gives to his readers. That's the kind of qualification he gives to himself. He doesn't completely suspend judgment. He just says, remember, you're not as smart as you might think you are. So where does this leave us then? If dogmatism, Montaigne says, that's not the answer because they think they know, but skeptical arguments show that the dogmatists don't really have ground to stand on. The academics don't have the right answer for Montaigne because their answer is, we can't know truth, so let's give up. Montaigne enjoys inquiring. Montaigne enjoys asking questions. And he says it's worth doing just for the sheer enjoyment of it. So he wants to continue seeking truth, even though he suspects we may never be able to find it.
So right now you're thinking, okay, he told us that Mark Twain's going to help us navigate our world and find truth. And so far it seems that he's saying, we can't really find it, but it's really fun to keep looking. He goes a step further. He goes beyond this because he adopts an attitude of perspectivism. Now, perspectivism is this idea that a single thing can be seen from multiple perspectives. It should not come as a shock to anybody. And if you've ever looked at an object while you're walking, you're aware that perspective changes, so does your view of an object. So perspectivism is used by these different philosophical schools, according to Montaigne. The dogmatists use it to show that everybody else who's argued about a topic cancels each other out, leaving the dogmatists of whatever school, the Stoics, the Epicureans, whoever, leaving them standing as the ones with the right answer, because everybody else, from their perspectives, canceled each other out. The academics also use perspectivism. They say, look, you can look at any question from so many perspectives that contradict one another, that no one can possibly be right. So again, how horrible is the fate of man? How miserable is our existence? We can't possibly find truth in Montaigne's account here. The Pyrrhonists also say there's so many contradictions out there, so many different perspectives. Their solution is we have to suspend judgment, right? This is that holding back. I will not judge. I will not judge. Okay? Montaigne, remember, his motto is, what do I know? This seems very skeptical. What do I know? Let's think about what that question might mean. Montaigne is a little bit different than these other schools of philosophy. As Robert Meyer, a philosopher who's writing Baylor, as he notes, to Montaigne, a thing is not, quote, altered or falsified by the perspective from which we see it. End quote. It's not altered or falsified. Seeing something from two different vantage points, even if it gives you completely opposite views, contradictory views of an object, that doesn't mean that you're wrong. That doesn't mean that the object isn't real. That doesn't mean that you have to falsify both opinions. That's not Montaigne's conclusion. Instead, each different perspective gives us more information about a thing, even if these different perspectives sometimes contradict one another. But the key here is that we can never see from every perspective. So total knowledge of anything, any idea, any actual object, total knowledge is impossible for Montaigne. It's not attainable by human faculties. This is where God comes in for Montaigne. He is a Catholic, although some have questioned that he just said he was a Catholic so he didn't get killed in the wars of religion. It's dicey to say you're a Catholic or a Protestant in the French wars of religion, so I don't really buy that argument. But he does maintain that he stays true to Catholic principles throughout his life. And this is where God comes in for him, that God alone can give us the sort of view that gives us total knowledge. And only a very few have been so close to God that they've gained that. Montaigne does not think he is one of those very few. So we can never see from every perspective. Total knowledge of any object, anything, any idea, is not attainable by human faculties. So what do I know, Montaigne asks? Well, he certainly doesn't know it all, right? He doesn't know absolute truth. He doesn't know total truth. What does he know? There's a lot of different perspectives about things. I totally forgot I had water over here. I was just thinking, man, I wish I had some water. Okay. So what do I know, asks Montaigne. He knows a lot about the perspectives from which he has viewed things, right? In fact, he deliberately seeks out different perspectives. That's one of the things he does in the essay. He forwards different arguments, views things deliberately from different vantage points. This is one of the things that makes the essay so fun, and also at times so frustrating, because he'll be arguing along one line, and then he'll suddenly reverse course and argue the complete opposite, and say, but I didn't think about this, and then he'll shoot himself down. This is Montaigne trying out these different perspectives. He can never get every perspective, but he can get as many as he possibly can. So what do I know? He knows something. We've made some progress, at least. So he does not deny that such knowledge or truth exists, total knowledge, total truth, but only that we are limited by our perspectives. Right? We can gain more knowledge about some things than others, Montaigne says. Specifically, the things that we are able to do from our perspective. Right? So things that we are more familiar with, we probably know more about. Again, this shouldn't shock anybody, right? So what is it then that we have the most access to? What can we know the most about? What can we enjoy the most perspectives about? Montaigne is himself. Okay, so what does he know? Well, he knows a lot about himself. This is the next stage in Mark Manning's development. So maybe he's a skeptic, seems like it, for a little while. But when you expand out, read more of the essays, then he seems to be a perspectivist, right? There's multiple perspectives from which we view truth. Now we can view the book as a whole. What is his entire project here? And this is Montaigne, the essayer of himself. And this word essay in French, I told you, means to try, to test out. It's related to the English word assay, like you assay gold, right? You test gold to see if it's really gold. And so it could be he's trying out something new. It could be that he's making an attempt at something. Or it could be he is testing himself. Spoiler alert, I think it's all three of those, for what it's worth. And to make sure that we know that this is the sort of wordplay he's after, in his very first essay, Montaigne uses that verb, S-I-A, in all three of those senses, almost in succession. So right from the very beginning, he tells his reader, hey, I may be up to something a little more complicated. So he becomes the assayer of himself. He is judging himself. This is really, really hard to do, to really take a critical look at yourself. Just to give you an idea of how Montaigne views this, he says, quote, this common attitude and habit of looking elsewhere than at ourselves has been very useful for our own business. We are an object that fills us with discontent. We see nothing in us but misery and vanity. In order not to dishearten us, nature has very appropriately thrown the action of our vision outward. We go forward with the current, but to turn our course back toward ourselves is a painful movement. Thus the sea grows troubled and turbulent when it is tossed back on itself. Look, says everyone, at the movement of the heavens. Look at the public. Look at that man's quarrel, at this man's pulse, at another man's will. In short, always look high or low, or to one side, or in front, or behind you. It was a paradoxical command that was given us of old by that god in Delphi. Look into yourself. Know yourself. Keep to yourself. Bring back your mind and your will, which are spending themselves elsewhere, into themselves. You are running out. You are scattering yourself. Concentrate yourself. Resist yourself. You are being betrayed, dispersed, and stolen away from yourself. Do you not see that this world keeps its sight all concentrated inward, and its eyes are open to contemplate itself? It is always vanity for you within and without, but it is less vanity when it is less extensive. Except for you, O man, said that god. Each thing studies itself first, and according to its needs, has limits to its labors and desires. There is not a single thing as empty and needy as you who embrace the universe. You are the investigator without knowledge, the magistrate without jurisdiction, and all in all, the fool of the farce. End quote. So in other words, we don't like to look at ourselves. We're not real pleased with what we see. If we start looking at ourselves, we see pretty quickly that we are ignorant, that we make mistakes, that we're not all that special. So nature has fortunately given us eyes that look outward. And that's what we spend all our time doing, looking outward. And it's painful to turn our gaze back upon ourselves, Montaigne says. And yet, me putting words in the mouth of the god Apollo here, god Apollo says, this is the absolute key. This is what you have to do. Know thyself. In order to do that, you really have to look at yourself. Every other creature in nature looks at itself, recognizes its limitations, and acts accordingly. But not man. Man wants the entire universe, and he's left the fool of the forest. So it is hard to look at yourself. How do you do it? How do you assay yourself? The creature of nature? So this is very difficult to do. So how do you do it? That's what Montaigne's after in this book. That's what he's doing here. So when he says he's giving an account of himself, he's not giving us biography, right? Anybody who's read just about any autobiography out there knows there's a lot of self-inflation that goes into most autobiographies and most memoirs. That's not what Montaigne is investigating here. That's still looking outward, right? It's presenting a view of yourself with the outward world. Montaigne here gives us his innermost thoughts, the way he thinks, right? And he may contradict himself over the course of the essays. He doesn't care. He says that I'm a different person from day to day, so what I think one day may not apply another day. When he starts writing the essays, he's a relatively, at least from our perspective, he's a young man. He died at 59, so maybe that makes 38, but not quite so young after all. He's in pretty good health when he retires. By the end of his life, he's racked by a pain of kidney stones. the same disease that killed his father, and he knew it killed his father, so he knew this is the one that bit my father, and he knew that that's probably what was going to happen to him too. So his circumstances have changed drastically over the course of his essays. So naturally, his thinking changes over the course of the essays. So in presenting these varied thoughts, he seems so scattered. What he's doing is showing us his mind in operation. Right? He's showing us the way he reasons about things. And in showing us, he's also showing himself. Right? By putting it down on the page, then he's better able to see the flaws of his reasoning, the weakness of his reasoning, the limits of his reasoning. Okay? So, what answer does this Montaigne give us about how to find truth? He does believe we can find truth. He does think you can know yourself. Right? That's the goal, know yourself. But the key is, aim lower. And look closer. Don't look for these grandiose truths about the universe. Start with yourself. That should be step one. You'll probably never make it to step two, Montaigne says. He certainly spent his entire life working on it. So aim lower, look closer, and keep looking, this Montaigne tells us. Now, what Montaigne has done here is a view that is steeped in skepticism. Right? He very much has a skeptical attitude at times. So does that mean he was a skeptic and he changed his mind later? I just told you he's very changeable. That's one interpretation, by the way, that these different phases represent different time periods of his life. I don't think that captures the whole movement of the essay. Instead, what I think we see is Montaigne taking these ideas, these techniques that skeptics develop, and he's applying them in a new way. He's not applying them to escape from the pressures of making judgment, to escape from the tribulations of making judgment. He's not seeking tranquility. He's using these same techniques to peel away all the external stuff about himself, all the excess, to really get to the heart of himself. So he takes skepticism and he applies it in a completely new way. And he doesn't reach a final answer. He's literally working on the essays until he dies. So how do we find truth? Aim lower, look closer, and keep looking, Montaigne tells us. A quick word about Descartes and Pascal, who came about a generation after Montaigne. I told you earlier they were both readers of Montaigne. Neither one of them liked Montaigne. Descartes did not like this idea that human reason was so fallible and reasoning. Now, Montaigne is often in textbooks pointed out as a forerunner to Descartes. Oh, Montaigne is a skeptic. Descartes also uses skepticism. Descartes, of course, I think, therefore I am, the famous Ergo Ergo Sum, he literally wipes away all of the things he holds to be true in the quest to find one thing that he can be absolutely certain. And he arrives at, I think, therefore I am, and he begins rewriting his knowledge from there. He does not like the view of human reason as fallible and weak. In fact, he thinks it's everything else about humans that is fallible and weak. The body is flawed, the senses are flawed. Only our reason can rescue us. So they are both skeptics, but Descartes reaches a completely opposite conclusion of Montaigne. Descartes is often pointed out as the father of the Enlightenment, the father of what will become the scientific revolution. So this idea of Descartes that reason is the thing that gives us absolute truth, that's really taken hold in Western civilization. Montaigne offers us an alternative to this. We can keep looking, we can keep seeking truth. We have to recognize the limitations of our own reason. So that aspect of Montaigne kind of gets left behind. Descartes wins that one. Pascal, on the other hand, is filled with anxiety and dread when faced with this skepticism. Right? The burden of not knowing. This is terrible for Pascal. Right? So he turns to theology. He turns to religion. I always think of a quote from a very famous philosopher. He says, God have mercy on the man who doubts what he's sure of. That's what I think of with Pascal. Right? It's this painful condition. God have mercy on the man. That philosopher, by the way, is Bruce Springsteen, for what it's worth. So, for Montaigne, no certainty, no problem. The thing about Montaigne is even in the face of all of this, in the face of uncertainty that to us, looking back from a perspective that is steeped in Descartes, looking back from a perspective that's steeped in postmodernism, this seems terrible. No certainty. How can we live with ourselves? Montaigne says, hey, that's the best we can do. Right? No certainty, no problem for Montaigne. He is always good humor. He never despairs. He's never filled with dread at the weakness of his own reason. He just recognizes that's his natural condition. So make the best of it. Another thinker that he points to who takes the same approach is Socrates. So we think of often Socrates as this really rational, logical guy who's poking holes in everybody else's argument, showing that they don't know anything. And Montaigne says, yeah, he does that. But what he does more than all is he lives in accordance with his own nature. He recognizes who he is, and that's how he lives his life. That's what Montaigne does here. No certainty, no problem from Montaigne. So what ultimately do we find in Montaigne? I told you that many, many people quote Montaigne. If you read any book about him, in the internet article, you'll see Nietzsche quoted, you'll see Emerson, you probably see T.S. Eliot, all of these names. So I'm going to quote somebody else reflecting back on Montaigne that you won't often see quoted. This is the French phenomenologist Maurice Merleau-Ponty, writing in the early 20th century. This book was probably published in the 50s, so maybe not the early 20th century. You get the idea. Merleau-Ponty says, "We think we have said all there is to say about him," meaning Montaigne, "when we say he is a skeptic, that is, that he questions himself and does not answer, refusing even to admit that he knows nothing, and holding himself to the famous, what do I know? None of this takes us very far. Skepticism has two sides. It means that nothing is true, but also that nothing is false. It rejects all opinions, and all behavior is absurd, but it thereby deprives us of the means of rejecting anyone as false. Destroying dogmatic, partial, or abstract truth, it insinuates the idea of the total truth with all the necessary facets and mediations. If it multiplies contrasts and contradictions, it is because truth demands it. Montaigne begins by teaching that all truth contradicts itself. Perhaps he ends up recognizing the contradiction is true." Now he's quoting Montaigne. "I do indeed contradict myself at random, but truth, as Demades said, I do not contradict at all." Ceases quoting Montaigne. "The first and most fundamental of contradictions is that by which the refusal of each truth uncovers a new kind of truth. Thus we shall find in Montaigne a doubt which rests upon itself and is endless. We shall find religion, and we shall find stoicism. It would be useless to pretend that he excludes any of these positions, or that he ever makes any one of them his own. But perhaps in the end he finds in this ambiguous self, which is offered to everything, and which he never finishes exploring, the place of all obscurities, the mystery of all mysteries, and something like an ultimate truth." So what do we find in Montaigne? We find the truth of ourselves, the truth of what it is to be human. So where does this leave us today? What do we take away from this? An answer to our question, how do we find truth in a world where even truth is open for debate? There are a few things I personally take away from Montaigne. First off, it is possible to be skeptical and not despair. Right, we are conditioned to think not thinking, making a judgment about something is wrong, is somehow weak. Right? Make up your mind. Right? That's not necessarily the case. Montaigne reminds us of that. It is possible to be skeptical and not be anxious about it. It's possible to be skeptical and not despair. We don't have to have an answer to everything, Montaigne tells us. And in fact, if you want an answer to everything, that's when you're going to despair. That's when you're going to be anxious. Any wonder that our society is so anxious, right? Because we expect to have an answer to everything. Avoiding dogmatism is a challenge that must constantly be faced, Montaigne reminds us. Right? He constantly, in the essays, is upbraiding himself for taking too settled a position on things, constantly reminding himself of the weakness of his own reason. We have to resist the urge to let our opinions stand in for knowledge. That's what Montaigne reminds us. So how do we find truth? Montaigne tells us, keep looking, but start here. Right? He tells us that moderation is a good way of life. I think we could use more of moderation today. But what do I know? Thank you.
Hopefully that's stimulated some thought. Any questions? Someone over here.
I have a question regarding the relationship of not only Montaigne, but the Renaissance skeptics generally with religion, because my impression is that most of them in the early Renaissance skeptics in the 16th century were Catholics and not Protestants. And at the same time, Persepsis Empiricus, they often look to, was seen as very anti-religious, and often, you know, notwithstanding what you said on the attitude that Pascal had, that he's often viewed as somewhat of an intellectual descendant of theirs because of that skepticism. But I wonder if you'd just comment on the relationship with religion.
Sure. So this relationship between religion and skepticism seems kind of strange to us looking back now from our modern perspective, but in the Renaissance, it seemed much more questionable to think that human reason could answer all of these questions. That seemed like expecting way too much of human reason in the early Renaissance especially. So the view then was that skepticism and faith were compatible because skepticism told you to recognize your own limitations. Don't expect to use your reason to answer all these questions. That's where God steps in. That's why we have the church. That's why we have religious dogma. It answers all these questions that we can't. I can't talk with my hands if I have glasses. So, you may have noticed I do that a little bit. In early Renaissance thinkers, skepticism and faith were not seen as contradictions. They were seen as complementary. So skepticism limits our faith in ourselves, which makes more room for our faith in God. And that's largely Montaigne's position. It's often called fideism, this idea that you have faith in God, and you don't have to be the one to figure out all the details. You leave that to the church that you have always been a member of, as Montaigne says. Now, obviously with the Protestant Reformation, we get a lot of these skeptical attitudes applied to Catholic dogma, to Catholic teaching. Now, you have documents that the church has relied on for centuries. They're discredited once a skeptical attitude is applied to them, and we see that, wait a minute, they don't add up to the way that we thought we did. So skepticism very much influences the Protestant Reformation, and so then you get the development of anti-religious skeptics, or at least anti-Catholic skeptics. Then you have Montaigne as kind of the next wave in this, so he's not an early Renaissance thinker, he's a little bit later. So he's now turning that back on the Protestants again, and the really extreme Catholic zealots. He says a lot of negative things about Catholic extremists in the book, too. There's one essay in particular called Of Cruelty, where he just excoriates both sides for all the terrible things that they do to other human beings. So you see him turning the table on the Protestants, like, how is it that you think you have all the answers to these divine questions? You're overestimating your own reason. So again, we see skepticism making room for Montaigne's faith. Now, fast forward a little bit later, and the pendulum swings back the other way, and now skepticism is seen as hostile to religion, and that's when a few people campaign for and ultimately get Montaigne's book placed on the index of prohibited books, where it'll remain for a couple of centuries. So you kind of see both attitudes swinging back and forth. And Montaigne, when he's on the upswing, he's on the right side at that point in history, where skepticism and faith go hand in hand. But once people recognize, wait a minute, skepticism can undercut faith, then it swings back the other way, and then he's in trouble. I mean, he's lost it, so it doesn't bother him, but you get an idea.
Other question?
Oh, it's on. Thank you for a fascinating introduction to Montaigne. What I find really interesting, and tell me if I'm misperceiving this, is he seemed to consider himself, am I putting it the wrong way?
No, I will say, he needs to turn.
Or I'll sit this way. Montaigne seems to have considered himself a very interesting and worthy topic to write about. In other words, he found value in the individual human subjective experience, limited though it may be. And in other words, we are a great instrument. We have a faculty for looking for truth and meaning, for making truth and meaning. We can adopt points of view that may be alien to us, take them into consideration. Yeah, we can take the perspective that, well, we can't really come to a final conclusion, but at the end of the day, we have to live our very own lives, and so we do make decisions, we do make judgments. But Montaigne seems to be of the mindset that, okay, I may make this decision today that this is the best course of action to me, but I could be wrong. I could change my mind in the future. The more important thing is, I am a being who is engaged in the process of looking for truth and meaning, and I will always be such a being, and I will always be open to new input. Is this a fair characterization of Montaigne? And then my question is really, what is it about us that we feel like we have to come to a steady, fixed position of who we are, what we know, and what we believe early in life, stick to that, defend it, be willing to die for it? That this stance towards reality seems to be contrary to what Montaigne is arguing for.
Yeah, that is a very good characterization of Montaigne, and it's worth pointing out that he was almost immediately by his critics accused of tremendous vanity in spending so much time writing about himself. But he says at the very outset, like, don't waste your time on such a vain subject. This is the only thing that he can write about, because this is the only thing that he really has knowledge of. So what do I know? Well, I know myself, so that's where I've got to start, is why he writes about himself. And you're right, he does absolutely think that we have this tremendous capacity to look at ourselves and start to uncover truth about ourselves. That quote about every other being in nature looks at itself first, assesses its limits, and then acts accordingly, that's kind of what Montaigne's after here. He says everybody else is trying to apply our reason too widely. They're aiming too high. Our reason is a great thing, but don't expect greater of it than it can possibly achieve. So he does think that our reason is this great instrument. We just have to make sure that we're using that instrument in the right way, aiming at the right target. And in answer to your second question, where does this attitude, this need for certainty come from? Montaigne says when he's discussing the dogmatists, he says most of this is these dogmatists laying out this position as though they've come up with a system of philosophy that explains the entire universe. He says most of this is just them putting on the mask of assurance. They just want people to think that they know what they're talking about, because we just like to make this impression on people. As somebody standing in front of a room full of people, I want to make that impression, right? That I know what I'm talking about. It's a very short step to wanting to appear like we know what we're talking about to thinking we really do know everything that we're talking about. So that's the problem with Montaigne. It's not that we form judgments. It's not that we have opinions. It's that of course we do. The problem is that we inflate our own judgments, our own opinions, and we think it's absolute truth. And he says, really, most of your conclusions, speaking of the dogmatist philosophy, most of your conclusions really are more a reflection of the kind of person you are, just your personal inclinations, your personal character. And now you've rationalized them to make them seem like philosophy is true. Nietzsche says something very similar in that way. This idea that philosophy really is just autobiography. That's what Montaigne says. It's trying to make yourself look better than you really are. So hopefully that answers it.
Yes.
Any questions?
One more question? Okay, well, I guess that'll be it then.
Thank you very much.